the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm Chris Prytower. On today's show, we're going to address an issue that many couples or individuals face in retirement, and that's dealing with the disposition of your estate upon your death and issues of incapacity. They can make it difficult for your heirs or a surviving spouse if you've not planned properly. So we want to alert you to these issues so you can avoid and properly plan for them. So today we're going to cover a variety of issues, seven of them in fact. The first is avoiding estate taxes, probate, incapacity, conflicts with heirs, elder abuse, ensuring that property is distributed according to your wishes, and finally, protection from creditors. All of the issues I just mentioned can be avoided with proper estate planning if you take the time to properly plan your estate. So, Jim, where do we begin?
You know, Chris, probably let's begin with the first issue of estate taxes, because this is where we've really seen a major change that came into play this year as a result of the tax law that was passed last year. Now, currently, the federal estate tax exemption is $11,180,000. So when you think of that number, the majority of Americans do not have to pay their estate taxes upon the death of the final spouse. Now, here's a great thing. If you have a trust, a married couple can double that exemption to $22,360,000. And that amount is indexed every year to the inflation rate. So basically, a couple could pass on over $22 million estate tax-free. So unless you're Mr. and Mrs. Megabucks, most Americans no longer face federal estate taxes.
So the new tax law passed by Republicans essentially removes most Americans from having to pay death taxes. That seems straightforward and an issue that doesn't need to be addressed in the future, but with the operating word being seems.
Well, you know, that's the one problem with the estate taxes. It changed several times in the last decade. There was a tax law that made it more favorable under George W. Bush, and then that sunsetted in the year 2010. And so everything was sort of up in the air. We really didn't know what the estate taxes were. And believe it or not, Chris, that year, there were no estate taxes until they actually passed a law and they raised that exemption over $3 million. But I wish that was the case, because this law, too, will sunset in the year 2025. So we could, depending on who holds power in Washington, be once again dealing with high tax rates and a lower exemption. So one strategy a couple may want to use is an irrevocable trust now to take advantage of the exemption before it sunsets in 2025, because there's no guarantee it'll remain at $11 million plus when it sunsets. Now, here's another issue, and it's actually a bigger one for most couples, and that is estate taxes and inheritance taxes at the state level. There are 13 states that have estate taxes plus the District of Columbia, and those estate tax rates range from 16% to 20% in the state of Washington. Now, the state of Washington has no income tax, but they have a 20% estate tax that begins around $2 million. So, and then you also have other states. The average for most states is a 16% tax rate, and that starts as little as $1.5 million, for example, in the state of Rhode Island. Now, in addition to estate taxes, there are six states that have inheritance taxes, and some states, like Maryland, get you both ways. They tax the estate at 16% on the last spouse that passes away, and then there's another inheritance tax on what's left over when it goes to your children. So what's really important here is you really need to meet with your advisor to discuss strategies to minimize or avoid paying these taxes, which may involve moving, quite honestly, to a tax-free state. 16 to 20% taxes is pretty steep, not to mention states like Maryland, which tax you and your heirs.
So it looks like knowing which states have estate taxes is probably more important now to know, as for most individuals, the exemption of $11.2 million at the federal level is no longer an issue for most couples or individuals. But what about probate?
The best way to avoid probate is through the use of a trust, which is what I recommend you do, as do most attorneys, especially if you have substantial assets. Now, probate fees, depending on the state, and they vary, can be as high as 3 or 4% or 5% on your estate. And more importantly, they can cause delays in settling the estate that in some cases could take years, depending on the complexity. Another way to avoid probate on death of the first spouse is through property titling. For example, if you own a house in joint tenancy with your spouse, one spouse passes away, it goes to the surviving joint tenant. Or, for example, if you're a beneficiary of an annuity contract.
Now, Jim, are there advantages or disadvantages with probate?
Well, when you think about it, through probate, it's a forum in which a will can be validated. During the probate process, the individual provisions of a will are interpreted to determine who will receive certain properties. So there is an advantage to that. It also provides for the appointment of someone to administer to the decedent's probate and estate. It's usually an agent of the court. It also provides a process which valid creditors of the decedent can get paid, by which the decedent's final, for example, income tax returns can be met. Maybe there's final bills. The disadvantages of probates, and there's three, everything in your estate is public. If you've ever heard about some of these well-known celebrity cases, about how much they were worth and all the machinations that went on with settling their estate, that was because they went through probate. And all of those legal battles, all the gossip and all of that came out in the probate process. So everything in probate is public. It also can delay the transfer. As I mentioned earlier, it could take several years. And then finally, the legal and administrative costs, which are usually a percentage of the estate and can be quite substantial depending on your assets.
Okay, so let's move on to planning for incapacity. I know it's not fun to talk about, but it's a high probability as individuals are now living longer, where you deal with anything from dementia, Alzheimer's, to having a stroke, to physical incapacity.
You know, there are a number of legal documents that aid in handling this issue. Living trust is one of them. Durable powers of attorney to avoid, for example, conservatorships. Then also you have something called durable medical powers. Now, we don't have time to cover each one of these documents, and I'm going to cover this in an interview that we're going to do following this show today. But what you want to be able to do is carry on the financial affairs without having to go through the court system. Because, I mean, simple investment decisions. I want to buy a stock. I want to sell a stock. Maybe you need to raise money to pay expenses, funeral expenses. If you're going through probate, all those kind of questions have to be approved by a court-appointed trustee. You just can't go out and do them on your own. Medical powers, for example, on making medical decisions, or powers of attorney, or, for example, being a trustee, all of these go to aid and help you carry on your financial affairs and make medical decisions if necessary.
Well, Jim, let's get into elder abuse here and also conflicts with heirs. I know this is something that you've spoken out on before, since you see it so often in your practice.
You know, when I first started my practice, Chris, this is really becoming a major issue that we did not run into several decades ago, but more often today, we are seeing children, friends take advantage of an ailing parent, or a parent or friend who has dementia, or let's say Alzheimer's. When I started my practice, more than 30 years ago, it was common to name the children as successor trustees. But I no longer recommend that, especially in larger and more complicated estates. I've come across way too many cases of elder abuse with children and heirs. And if you do name children, I strongly recommend you consider maybe a successor trustee or co-trustee, or let's say a fiduciary that works with your children. And there's a number of reasons I recommend this. Number one, it protects the parent from elder abuse. Number two, it keeps the peace and harmony in the family. And boy, you never know what happens until after you pass on and money is involved and different spouses. You would be surprised at the legal problems that sometimes arise as conflicts come up between children and spouses. And it's very good, for example, in the more complicated issues of income and estate taxes, or, for example, when you're dealing with a large IRA, something called an IRA stretch provision, so the kids know what the tax consequences. And a lot of children just aren't up to date on the tax laws, the income tax laws, the filing requirements, all the things that you have to do in settling an estate. So the main issue that concerns me today more than anything else is elder abuse, and you're more likely to run into this when you appoint children or a close friend. When you have a fiduciary or a co-trustee with the financial institution, this can generally be avoided.
And Jim, the reason why I brought that up about elder abuse, I know you've seen it so often in your practice. Do any anecdotes come to mind as far as clients that have really been impacted by this?
You know, Chris, I can think of several that are going to illustrate the point. The first case I'm going to talk about is, let's just say this is the case of Mrs. B. This was a second marriage. They were married well over three decades, but there were children from both families. He had a daughter. She had three children. And a very successful businessman. We helped negotiate the sale of his business. We had a charitable trust involved. So this was a very complicated estate. And also over time with management, the estate was doubled. And so it was a rather substantial estate. Husband passes away, and the wife wanted to do something. She said, you know what? I don't want to wait till when I pass on for my daughters and my son to enjoy what we've accumulated. So she made a substantial gift of $1 million to each one of her children. And it was sort of a test. How do they handle this money? And so that was done. And unfortunately, it was disastrous. They spent it. You know, there's not one of them that actually ended up saving any of the money. It was new cars. It was vacations. It was buying a bigger home. None of them saved it. And so that really got her thinking. She goes, you know, I'm glad the way we set this estate up. And so what she did is her husband's estate would provide income to the children, but not the principal. She had in her half of the estate, she could do whatever she wanted. And part of that was making a gift to her children. She then, seeing the way she handled the money, changed the estate like her husband's, so that the assets would not go directly to the children. They would only have access to the income. Well, she invited the kids in, kind of reprimanded them and said, look, we had a trial run here. You did not handle this money. It's my own opinion that this money needs to be managed for your own benefit because you have shown you're not capable. So she told the children this. To make a long story short, what happened is she moved, later sold her house, and she moved into a retirement home. And when she did, she wanted to find an attorney closer by. Well, the children suggested an attorney that she work with. To make a long story short, the attorney was in cahoots with a trustee that was going to remove her from her own trusteeship of the trust and eventually change the disposition of her trust because the kids wanted access to the principal. So there's one case where fortunately we caught it in time, and now there is a trustee that is overseeing the estate. She's still living and she's still in good health. And so there was a case. Another case is parents had several children. They named two of the children to take care of. Dad dies. Two of the children come in to assess mom, but in doing so, they leveraged mom's home. First, they put in a mortgage, of which they took the proceeds out for investments that they wanted to make in real estate for themselves. Then they put a reverse mortgage, and so they took nearly, Chris, a third of the entire estate was eaten up by two of the children.
Wow. Well, again, as an advisor, you really are on the front lines of elder abuse. It's just yet another thing you see in the financial accounts when there are large requests for withdrawals by a successor trustee or heir, or even unusual activity in an account.
You really are, because when you're handling the finances of an estate, you know, you're doing the reviews, you see the income tax returns, and you're managing the money. You know, that's the old story is follow the money. And that's really the case, because what you're looking for is unusual activities, sudden withdrawals of a large amount. We had a one case where one child, all of a sudden, the client doubled their monthly distribution. And unfortunately, by doubling the monthly distribution, they were actually dipping into principal because the returns weren't large enough to double the distribution rate. Well, later found out through having the client come in for a review that she was helping out a son. And I said, well, you know, you're giving your son over $5,000 a month and you're dipping into principal. You cannot do this for an extended period of time, or you yourself are going to find yourself in trouble. So these are the kind of things that you look for, Chris. We had another case, for example, where all of a sudden a client was calling up and wanting us to make certain kinds of investments that really didn't make sense. And especially since we had a long-term relationship with this client, they were just somewhat odd. And fortunately, we were able to get in touch with his wife, and she said he was being evaluated for dementia, which was the case. He was diagnosed with dementia, and so he was removed from the account. But this is why you want to have usually backup people in your plan that your advisor can account. Like in this case, you know, we got a hold of the wife and we said, you realize this is what John is doing and this makes absolutely no sense financially and could actually be putting the portfolio at risk with some of these decisions. You know, we really are on the front lines because we see what happens with investment activities, whether it's the case of the example I just gave of John calling, making or wanting us to make financial decisions in the portfolio that made no sense, or seeing large distributions from the account.
Well, and again, I'm glad we're bringing this up because it's sometimes an uncomfortable thing to think about or talk about. But if these issues aren't nailed down, it really can have a devastating impact on families. Well, Jim, one of the things that we always like to do on the show is boil everything down to a few takeaways that listeners can apply to their own situation. Now, the first thing is to have a plan. Also, incorporate estate planning as part of your plan. Update it due to health, wealth, and family changes. Now, this is not the set it and forget part of your plan. The tax law changes require that you update and monitor your estate plan. That's not to mention health issues. The third thing is set up a trust with multiple heirs and consider using a co-trustee or fiduciary to protect yourself from elder abuse and help your heirs with the financial aspect of handling and settling an estate. Number four, have backup contacts that your advisor has access to in case something unusual occurs. And then lastly, review and monitor throughout your retirement. Have annual reviews with your financial advisor to stay abreast of tax and market changes or even your very own health issues that could have an impact on your financial and estate plan. Now, Jim, it's time for our real life case study, and that's a hypothetical illustration based on real life examples. As always, names and circumstances have been changed to protect privacy. And for our listeners, we do have slides online available at financialsense.com. And those slides do illustrate the points that are being made here today.
All right, let's talk about Ben and Barbara McDowell, both age 63. When they came in to see us, they're talking about retiring within probably the next 1 or 2 years. We did a health questionnaire on both of them. They had longevity that ran on both sides of the family. Both of them were in good health. Ben's life expectancy, age 90. Barbara, age 93. This is probably one of the big things that I have seen since I began my practice, Chris, is that with improvements in healthcare, medicines, and things like that, is life expectancy has increased substantially. When I got in the business, the average life expectancy for a male was in the 70s. Today, it's in the 80s, and we have numerous clients that are in their 90s. So anyway, life expectancy for Ben and Barbara, 93 for Barbara, 90 for Ben. Risk tolerance was moderate for both of them. Their investment objective was income with capital preservation. Let's talk a little bit about Ben. He was a regional sales manager, been with the same company for roughly about 20 years. He travels several times a month on business. The pay is excellent, but he feels like he wants to begin a new chapter of his life. He has been contributing to his company's stock purchase plan for years and has accumulated a large concentrated position. And unfortunately, most of his assets were in the employer's stock. He's always invested heavily in precious metals, since that is how his father taught him to invest. And he's concerned about how he has invested now that he's finally considering retirement. Barbara, on the other hand, is a little bit anxious and excited at the same time at the prospect of her husband retiring. She currently enjoys babysitting her grandkids a couple days a week, but looks forward to getting more time with her husband, especially considering the amount of time he travels. She's concerned about the cost of retirement, given her husband's family health history and her expected longevity herself. She hopes they can maintain their current lifestyle as long as possible, but she values their independence and wants to remain that way. Barbara is probably a little bit more conservative than her husband and is concerned about the large loss in the portfolio, which mainly had to do with precious metals. Looking at what was important to both of them, number one, given longevity concerns, not outliving their assets. Managing medical costs, because as you age and get older, medical costs increase. Having retirement income and reliable income at that. And that's one thing we had to point out with the concentrated position in metals. There was no income coming from that. Reducing risk in the portfolio. Their total income was roughly about $126,000. His salary was $165,000. So there was surplus of $39,000. Looking at their retirement budget, total income spending would drop roughly about $100,000. Social Security would be $42,000. Ben's pension from the company would be $29,000, so there was roughly almost a $30,000 shortfall. Taking a look at their assets, their primary residence was $330,000. They had a rental property at $175,000. Ben's retirement 401k was $850,000. Barbara's was $90,000. His employer stock was about $250,000. And various business interests that he had were 96. So total investment assets were roughly about $1.3 million. $80,000 of liability was mainly on the rental, which was positive and cash flow positive, which was a good thing to have because a lot of times you run into people that have rental properties that aren't cash flow positive, and that's not what you want when you head into retirement. So adding it all up, we wanted to reduce risk, provide a predictable stream of income so they would not outlive their assets and manage medical costs going forward. We did a balanced portfolio and we reduced the precious metals down substantially. So what that would do is that would produce roughly about $38,000 of income a year. That would leave them of a surplus of roughly about $8,000. And here's the thing I told them about that surplus. That will increase over time with dividend increases, but we needed to keep saving and putting money aside because in the latter years, especially when they get into their 80s and possibly 90s, their medical cost would go up substantially. And we told them about the average couple shelling out almost $260,000 out-of-pocket expenses for Medicare premiums, drug prescriptions, and God forbid, if they had to go into a long-term care facility. So they would have $8,000 of basically surplus income. What we did is we reduced their risk down as a result of the way we diversified. We reduced part of the portfolio's position in the company stock. And so overall, we created a predictable income stream, which Barbara really liked because she said, you know, she saw so many upheavals in the portfolio. Number one, with the stock market, since that was where most of Ben's assets were. And of course, with precious metals, when they were going up, it was great. When they go down, and when they went down a lot, it wasn't.
That's not so great.
Yeah, so she really wanted to have predictable income. So that was pretty much what we did in this case. You know, the good thing here is they had a good pension. Ben did. And they had substantial assets, not a lot of debt. The only debt was on the rental property, which was cash flow positive. So a really good case, pretty straightforward. And we would be generating some surplus income. We talked about building up a bank reserve and eventually setting up an annuity type plan should either one of them get into a long-term care facility later on in life.
Well, tomorrow we will have Elizabeth Morgan on the show of Elizabeth Morgan and Associates. And Elizabeth Morgan provides legal advice and service in the area of domestic and international estate planning and trust administration. It's a show you won't want to miss.
Well, that concludes this week's show. On behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.